Welcome to Security.com, the podcast where we're bringing together in-depth intel, real talk, and the human side of cybersecurity. We're actually recording from Hacker Summer Camp in Las Vegas here, and I'm your host, Dan Mellinger. Each episode, I'll be joined by industry experts, defenders, and voices from the front lines to explore the latest enterprise security insights straight from the pages of Security.com and the minds shaping the field. Joining me in the studio today are two very special guests, Simon Edwards, the CEO and founder of SE Labs, and Adam Bromwich. He's the CTO of Symantec for a long, long time, and now the Enterprise Security Group at Broadcom. We're diving into the details on cybersecurity testing, which has been one of the more consistently dramatic topics in the industry. So I figured we start with some context. Simon, as someone who's led kind of independent cybersecurity testing for years, can you just kind of give us an overview of what you guys do and kind of where it started to where it is now?
I think the easiest way to describe it is it started with antivirus testing back in the very late 90s, where you've got these tools that claim to do amazing things and you have to try and prove as a tester, do they actually work? And the easiest way to do that is to use real threats. And then you kind of extend that concept out to, well, if I'm going to test an email security product or a firewall or whatever, the easiest thing to do, but is also kind of the hardest, is to basically behave like a real attacker and start the attack from the very beginning and work your way all the way to the end where you steal information or damage systems or whatever. So that could be antivirus, it could be email cloud services, it could kind of be anything, stuff that's not even been invented yet. If you do the test like a real attacker, if you test like a hacker, then you should be able to work out if these things do what they claim to do.
Interesting. So it's almost like pen testing with kind of a consistent performance metric tied to it.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Because with a pen test, you're going against an organization with its policies and its whole stack. Whereas here, we're attacking our own systems with one or more, and you can do more products in the way. So with not to get too ahead of ourselves, but you can do an XDR test where you combine all these things together into one platform and then see how they would react as you penetrate and breach through them.
Oh, very interesting. And Adam's going to be representing more of the vendor side of this discussion because there's kind of two halves to this story, really. And how do you see testing evolve and how do we make use of it here at like Symantec, for example?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's two halves, but we're pretty unified in the common need and desire for real world types of tests. When we test a product in a real life situation as a vendor, we get the best feedback and results and understanding of how our product is performing. If it's being tested in any kind of artificial way or very narrow way, we can tell ourselves that it's performing well, but
it happens a lot.
Which happens a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not, the goal is not to just get something great to say about our product. The goal is for the product to actually succeed against an attacker. Attacks are incredibly complex and they involve lots of different dimensions. And so it really requires testers to understand all those dimensions, replicate all those dimensions. And it requires vendors to actually want that value back. And so that's been a partnership that we've had for a long time with testers that I think has been really valuable.
I've always said that if the vendor approaches a test from a kind of engineering point of view, from a QA point of view, you're going to get success because we'll either find problems or we won't, and then you can fix them or you can celebrate. And then there's a marketing bonus if you do well, mm-hmm. but if you approach it with a marketing perspective and budget, yeah. you're almost always going to be disappointed because mm-hmm. you're probably not going to always get 100%. There's always something that you're going to dig out. So I think for good tests, if it's being done with the right ultimate goal of making the product better
yeah.
and not just showing off that, yay, we're the best, mm-hmm. that's probably the best way of doing it.
I like that, going in with like the intent, right? The intent is to discover and become better. And if you do better, that makes your marketing a lot easier, by the way. So your marketing performs better because you're marketing something that's inherently improved, right? Ah, that's interesting. That's a good segue too, is like, what are some of the like big misconceptions about performance testing in cybersecurity, right? Like we said, there's always a lot of like drama around it. And I think, a kind of a well-earned cynicism, right, to the premise of it, right, being funded by vendors or whatnot. So what are some of the misconceptions you think you like to correct early on?
Yeah, well, like, I guess the first thing I'd say is the solution to most of those is transparency. Because no matter what you think I've done wrong in a test, if I tell you everything that I've done and share all the information, I can either prove that you're wrong and I've done the perfect test, which doesn't exist, or you can point out where I've gone wrong and I can correct myself. And I think historically there have been testers who have been incompetent and maybe not known that they are, or maybe have known. So you can be consciously incompetent or purposefully incompetent. Yep. Some are corrupt, quite frankly, or have been in the past. So, and some of a combination of both. So when you've got that, you get a horrible kind of, I don't know what the word is, but a sense, an atmosphere that testing isn't credible. So when you do come out and do a good test, there's always going to be a little bit of cynicism because you think, oh, well, who's paid for it? Well, they've got 100% and they paid them however much money. Yeah. Well, they've just bought a result. And what you don't hear stories about are, for example, we had a company come to us and say, we want to pay all this money to be tested. And we're like, cool, we'll do that. Mm-hmm. They didn't detect anything. And none of their team knew that they were being tested. And what we realized they thought they were doing was buying a badge. Because when we went onto their website, all the other badges that they had were ones where you just spend money. Mm-hmm. And there's actually no testing involved.
Yep.
And they were probably quite surprised when we said, well, we've just run a whole load of threats and you haven't detected anything. Because they weren't expecting us to actually do the work.
Run anything.
Yeah.
That's interesting. There's a lot of awards that you would submit for, and a lot of them are simply pay for badge, right?
Exactly.
And so,
yeah.
That's interesting. Okay, well, I think that makes sense, and it's applying kind of the rigors of the scientific method, right? Mm-hmm. Like, make it transparent, show your work, and then people can repeat it or disprove it, but yeah, the data's out there.
And admit to it, you know, if you're a tester and you've made a mistake, and say Adam's team point out that we've messed up, mm-hmm, yeah, own it and mm-hmm fix it. You know, don't become defensive and say, well, we're not going to share our samples with you anymore for whatever weird reason.
Speaking from other experience,
yeah,
I'm
never,
sure.
Yeah, I've never
happened before.
Never experienced that.
Well, I mean, that's a really good, like, moving into some of the actual, like, I guess, methodologies, right? Because it's hard to do real-world tests, and it's hard, cyber, very complex, attackers are always changing their methods. If you know what's coming, you know have an advantage, or you can tune your solution to go stop this narrow band that may not be realistic. What are the trade-offs between kind of lab-based testing and building kind of tests that mimic real-world simulations, right?
Yeah, that's simulations are a nice word. We always try and say we don't simulate attacks, because there are technical tools that will automate and simulate attacks. Mm-hmm. But those simulations aren't the real thing. So if Adam's product or anyone else's product doesn't detect one of those, you kind of can't blame them, because it's not actually an attack. So the alternative is to do it with real people. It's much more expensive. It takes a lot longer. So there is a trade-off there. If you want to push a load of automated attacks through a system on a weekly basis, a tool is useful for that.
Yeah.
But if you want to know, if a group of people sit down and try and penetrate using the tactics that we know this group uses or that group uses, you really have to just take the hit and say, this is going to take 8 weeks, it's going to cost you a load of money, but the quality of the results at the end of it will actually help you improve the product. And if the consumers of that report believe that this is important, then it's a great marketing tool as well. You haven't just run a vulnerability scanner or something that spurts out a load of PCAP binaries or something like that.
Does that make it harder to make it repeatable, or does repeatability matter?
Repeatability does matter. We capture everything that we do. So this is actually super important, actually. When we say to a team, we found a problem, we can't just say, here's a couple of binary files, good luck. We have to give them the opportunity to replay that attack and fix it. And if they have fixed it, replay it again. Has it actually fixed it, or are you still working on it, kind of thing? So for us to be a useful consultancy, we have to make it repeatable.
Interesting. Well, and that goes to you. How do we, on the back end of this stuff, use this kind of testing data to improve the products?
Well, I mean, we're lucky that we have vendors who provide the transparency, provide the ability to repeat the attack. But look, we look at every possible, anytime we miss something, we want to really understand it. And we want to be able to see what it is that caused the miss. And that focus on the real world type testing is so critical for us, because our bandwidth is limited in how much time we can spend on improving our product. And we'd so much rather spend it on actual value for customers, like this attack made it through. We need to make sure that this vector doesn't occur for customers, versus something that's not real world, something that's a tool that is just identifying something that, you know, maybe one of our other 10 technologies blocks, but this one technology did not block because they were only testing that one technology. That's a waste of our time. We have to do it in order to do well in this test, but it's not actually providing any value for a customer.
Yeah.
So the value of the real world test to us is fully aligning our investment with what is actually valuable to customers, as opposed to just doing well on a test.
You can almost like prioritize a little bit, because you're like, this is like,
that's right.
There's like a proof of concept, right? Like, this is something that we probably need to fix or have a mitigation against.
If it made
it
through one of Simon's tests, it means that it evaded all of the different levels that we have in place.
Interesting.
And we actually internally, when we evaluate our efficacy, just running tests internally, we put those at the top of the list. Anything that's going to evade all layers of protection, that's the number one thing that we're going to tackle. You know, if it's getting through 2 out of the 10 layers, that is just, it's going to be lower down on the priority list, you know? And so that...
That makes a lot of sense, but that can almost speak to, in a lot of cases, maybe perhaps savings, because I mean, if we're going to be realistic, it's expensive, right? Yeah. Extremely time consuming to set this stuff up, especially if you're doing it multiple times. So. Yeah.
But something interesting came out of a test we did recently for Broadcom, where the products that we tested scored 100%, which is in itself exceptionally good. But the scientists behind the product still used the results to analyze how the product had responded so they could make it maybe more efficient. Mm. So it wasn't a case of we got 100%, well done, pop the champagne. It was like, right, now let's see why we got 100%. How did we get it? And can we have done that differently behind the scenes? So there's still engineering benefits, even when you get that marketing bonus win.
Oh, shift some of the block left or further, right? And minimize things down chain or requirements to have more to stop, kind of a thing.
Yeah, I mean, who knows what they do? I mean, these are geniuses that are building the code.
But that's that guy over there.
All proprietary.
That's a good segue, because I'd like to know, like, a lot of the testing seems to be kind of limited to a single product, maybe a single type of attack, right? And so how well do you think current methodologies, just as an industry, are testing for layered security models, right? Because large enterprise certainly, right? But even smaller and mid-sized businesses now are deploying more tooling. There's no shortage of security solutions, startups, all that fun stuff. So I'm curious how the methodology, do you think it's adequately testing against these kind of layered approaches?
There's two kind of ways I can think of layered approaches. So if you think of a really well managed endpoint product, you've got different layers. You've got things like reputation and behavioral and signatures and stuff. But then you've also got, as you say, different tools. So you've got an XDR, maybe potential situation going on. And it's not really the methodology that changes. It's all the hassle of getting that set up, because we have done an XDR test with 6 different vendors, all of whom were willing to participate and to integrate with each other. And it took us months. So I'm assuming if I was a real enterprise doing this with vendors who were perhaps less inclined to work with each other, it could maybe take a year to get an XDR thing set up, maybe. So that's less about the testing methodology and more about the setup and getting agreement. It becomes more diplomatic, I think, more political.
Well, yeah, and even more so because when you think about it, right, you're talking about basically rolling out a large customer deployment functionally is what you're doing, right? And so there's entire industries based around charging people to go set that up, right? So
maybe we should do that instead.
It'll be an implementer, right?
So the methodology shouldn't change. I mean, our methodology wouldn't, because we're doing that whole attack from beginning to end. But the more you become synthetic, the more you have to take into account these other bits. Mm-hmm. And then maybe you do have to change your methodology. So if your methodology is put a USB drive into an endpoint and copy a file off it, which is valid, but quite weak,
yeah.
And then you're suddenly testing an email service, well, how does that work? You have to adapt the methodology to take into account the path mm-hmm. of the threat through to the target. Does that seem reasonable?
No, it seems very reasonable. Mm. I agree. It's a pain in the ass. I mean, it you can only do so much. I mean, like, right. You don't just have to set up everything. Mm-hmm. You also have to provide attacks.
Yes.
And those attacks have to actually trigger some. Though, you know, you may trigger none of those. Mm-hmm. You may trigger, you know, one out of seven layers. And so... it's a lot of work for.
And you have to, then you have to prove what actually happened.
Little result, yeah.
Because your product might say, "I've seen that and I've blocked it," but I've seen loads of antivirus products claim to do it. But you have to do the forensics afterwards to say, "Well, it alerted. It definitely did alert. But then we saw the bad thing do all of this activity, or we were able to get control of this or that." So you can't trust the alerts. You have to do the forensics afterwards as well. So it's not just the attacking methodology, it's providing the evidence. Because Adam can say, well, we can see from the logs that we blocked it. And I would have to go, well, actually, we can see from our logs that you didn't block it.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because my next question, you guys are running right into the answer here. But, you know, how should vendors and users think about the difference between prevention and detection, right? Because a lot of the testing is kind of prevention-based, right? Like. Yeah, and so like you guys are actually walking your way into that question beforehand. But yeah, like how should users be thinking about the differences between those two, especially when it comes to testing, but real world?
I mean, look, I coming from Symantec and a history that is, I think, more of a kind of set it and forget it type of methodology coming from Norton days.
Yeah, yeah.
Prevention has always been like very exciting. Right? Yeah. Why would you would want to prevent everything? But the reality is attacks are incredibly complex now. Mm. And attackers are typically living off the land. So they're often not doing anything that you can really prevent. There's often many steps to an attack.
Today. And living off the land is when attackers are kind of in your networks, using legitimate tools, surveying what's going on, seeing patterns, and trying to evade detection.
Behaving like administrators. Yes, right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's right. If an administrator can do this on this machine, then we can't block it. And so the attackers have learned that, and they said, great, well, we're just going to do that. So the need to be able to detect activity that's happening and to be able to have visibility into that activity, even if you can't block it, is paramount. And so, like, I don't see, the short answer to your question is I don't see a difference between protection and detection. They're both incredibly essential.
Yeah.
To me, it's all about the that end result, and are you getting breached or not? And if you are getting breached, how easy is it for the SOC to be able to get in the way of that breach? I still have a visceral desire to make that happen before the breach.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think it's a lot less effective if you're just saying, hey, we saw something before. But you want the whole thing. You want to know that if it does happen, that it did happen. And you want as much data as possible ahead of time to know what might be possible. And so I think the greatest products actually are focused on making that breach as least likely as possible, enabling the SOC to be able to get in the way of that breach. That's ultimately the end result.
Yeah.
We've been working together for many, many years on testing, and one of the analogies that we adopted early on for real-world testing, I think, is really appropriate for this, which is, it's like when an auto manufacturer tests the safety of a car.
Yeah.
And we know that testing seatbelt strength and airbag deployment times is not it's not testing the result. Yeah. The result is, how did that crash test dummy do when you slammed into a wall? Yeah. What happened? What was the actual result? And that real-world testing is much more about that. It's less important which technology it was that helped minimize that breach.
As long as the net
result. As long as the result was the result. And so I look at protection detection as kind of a continuum, and whatever the technology is that prevents that breach is good with me.
I think from a testing perspective, it's down to what the customer's requirement is. So if you've got, when I say the customer, someone who's buying a product, they might want to have a detection product in place. They might think they've already got protection set up sufficiently and they want to keep an eye on what's going on. So it's down to their attitude to risk. It's down to how they want to operate their teams. They may decide we've detected a breach and we're just going to nuke all of our systems, re-image and start again, having not learned the lessons from the incident, so it probably happened again. But they may decide that that fits their approach to doing business. Whether others might want to spend hours going through a post-breach situation and working out exactly what happened, who did it, how did they get in, that kind of thing. I mean, they'll never know who, but they can try. So, and there's probably a mixture. There's probably companies between those two extremes who, depending on who they've got working with them on that day, they might make that decision.
That's actually, it's interesting, and it kind of leads into one of... Security generally has been kind of a battle between creating too much friction for users and then balancing that against friction for attackers, right? And I think no discussion about testing methodologies in cybersecurity would be complete without talking about MITRE results, right? And like, I think one of the reasons that people are kind of critical of testing in general is like people tune their solutions to be very prevention centric for MITRE tests, and right, and so they're chasing the 99th percentile numbers.
Sometimes can be opposite to that though, because sometimes they produce products specific for MITRE tests, which are only detection mode. So they will even turn off elements of protection because that would have spoiled the attack chain. They want to show they can detect all of these elements.
Everything,
so if protection's turned on at this point, it will get stopped and they can never demonstrate it, and then they get into trouble with MITRE for not having covered that area, so they have to like artificially hamper the product almost, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, well, and that's the, you know, overly blocking or setting to detect everything, flag everything, isn't generally a real way to configure a large enterprise system, because you're like, literally it would just be noise, right? It'd be like
and
sitting in a fire alarm
going
off
all
day, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, I guess the question of that is like, what are the challenges of for users trying to interpret data where like we're detecting 99.99999% of everything, right? When that was tuned to do that specifically, like how do we overcome that as kind of an industry standard?
And of course, what the tester, what my results would tell you is not that it detects 99 or 100% of everything, but it detects 99 or 100% of the things that we did in that test. And all you can do really is to draw some conclusions to say, well, the product's probably quite good to achieve that. And then you can look over the history of testing and say, well, the Symantec product, the Broadcom product, the McAfee product, whoever, that's been consistently good for a decade, so it's probably good today. Whereas some newcomer that's not got a proven track record, you might be a little bit more careful with making a serious decision with that product.
Do you have any advice for CISOs and teams to use testing to help evaluate tools that they may want to use or to see how effective things may be in the environment?
Well, we often actually, I mean, we test a lot with companies like yours, but we also work with the enterprises who buy the products. So usually what happens is if you're going to spend $1 million on a firewall or set of firewalls, you will do a bake-off involving those vendors. But of course, those tests are compromised to a degree. So sometimes they'll come to us for a second opinion, and we'll do those tests on our own in our own lab with the same products and the same configurations. And it might be that they get the same result. And sometimes we'll say, well, look, this product is really good and this one's almost as good, but your existing team is already trained on this one that's almost as good. So probably you're going to get a real world better experience using that.
The gap just might be larger because they just, the time to spin up and learn to use the tool alone is going to be kind of a security gap.
So it becomes a business decision, or maybe this one's so much cheaper you can use the money you've saved to do something else that you need to do. So it's not as straightforward as saying this certificate means you should do that thing.
Yeah.
But it's useful ammunition.
Okay.
And if you can't find a product, if the product you're considering has not been tested, mm-hmm. or it hasn't been tested by a good tester, again, that should be a cautionary situation.
Is that pretty common?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about this earlier. Like, I think vendors like to avoid testing.
Yeah.
Right, they feel like, you know, they'd rather not be put on the stage. To me, I think the best advice I would give is to look for testers who are super transparent, back yeah. to your point about transparency. I mean, and I think that when you look at, even just a casual look at different test reports, mm-hmm. something that is straightforward, easy to understand, simple, and transparent is going to give you a reasonably good answer. Whereas I think a lot of tests, what you see is a lot of complexity. Mm-hmm. The more complexity, the more that things are obscured and you can't understand, you know, there's no detection rate, there's no false positive rate. Mm-hmm. Those then, you know, it's more likely that it's a gameable test, or it's something that vendors are,
or there's additional context to. That just you can't know.
That's that right. The it's testing. Right. It's yeah. just so hard to know the result, whether the
parameters
is
that went into
reliable.
The front end.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. I would look for simplicity, transparency. I think those are the main things.
I do worry a bit that some of our reports do come across as too complex, because what we're trying to do is to prove that we've ticked all the boxes and tested for false positives mm-hmm. and done all our due diligence.
Be thorough.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people just read the first three pages and go, right, that's got an A, that's fine. You know?
Right.
And
right.
so it's hard to know where to
right.
stop.
Well, that's just going to always be a challenge. I think there's no silver bullet to that. Do people just want one score?
Yeah.
Yes, of course, but one score is not enough. Like, you need a false positive rate. Do people always understand what a false positive rate is? No, and it does require explanation, but it means you got it wrong. Yeah. And you need to see how often you get it wrong and see how often you get it right.
Yep.
So like it can be a little bit complex, but I think people go way into the weeds. Yeah. And I don't think security has to be complex. I think it can be explained, and but it's never gonna just be one score. That's right. It can't just be one score. Yeah. Products are complex. Attacks are complex.
The threat landscape is getting more
complex. Again, back to my analogy about
car.
I mean, can you say what the best car is? I mean, like,
well, people are making
car safety.
People are making political decisions. I mean, you know, there are some brands of car people are getting rid of because of how they feel about politics.
You mean Elon Musk? I love the bumper stickers, right?
Yeah, exactly. But that's got nothing to do with the technology. That's mm-hmm. about a feeling, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. There's many dimensions.
Well, talking about innovation, right? The landscape's changing. So like future looking too, right? You're starting to see AI-enabled attacks, a lot more going after the human element, things like that. Polymorphic malware, like things are getting faster and a little more advanced, right? We're talking about complexity. How do you think testing needs to evolve to remain effective within that landscape?
Well, you can do, again, you just have to behave like the bad guy. You have to test like a hacker. That's going to be my little catchphrase, which I have trademarked, by the way. And there was another vendor came up with a product to detect fake audio. And the idea is it's kind of an anti-fraud thing to protect mm-hmm. consumers. And we did this test where I basically spoke a bunch of phrases and we had an AI trained on my voice, because I do have a podcast. Mm-hmm. And so there's hours of my voice out there to do this with.
Yeah.
And it was very, very good. And they ran it through the technology. And there were two interesting things that came out of that test. One was the computers got it right. Okay, the AI detected which version of me was fake and which was real.
That's heartening to hear, yeah.
But the engineers at this company thought the computer got it wrong and they started panicking. They were like, well, that's clearly his real voice and our computer's telling us that it's fake.
Mm.
And so the humans got it wrong and the computer got it right. So in some ways it's a good story, because if the technology is developing to run these extra attacks, testers can be flexible enough to test it and the products are actually working, the security products are stopping the bad thing. Then maybe this is a little fight between AIs and maybe the good guys could be winning, possibly.
That's very heartening to hear, especially with deep fakes. And like you're saying, you only need so much audio and mm-hmm. people.
You only need half an hour. I mean, you're going to be easy to clone, I guess.
After this show, right? After this episode.
That's what we're going to do with this one.
Yeah, great. Well, I mean, I think we've had a good discussion thus far. I have two more questions, one for each of you. Adam, what advice would you give kind of security leaders who may be overwhelmed trying to be like, what's marketing, what's not? I know you kind of went into it with the simplicity side. How do you use testing when you're trying to evaluate like if a technology is good or not?
I'm not often in a position of buying technologies.
Yeah.
but I think relying on marketing claims is definitely the worst thing you can do. It can be really difficult.
And I take zero offense to this, yeah. By the way.
Well, I think good marketing, right? I mean, I think we can get a whole conversation about that, right? I mean, good marketing is really about just kind of showing what the product is about.
Agreed.
Yeah. And showing what the company is about. And,
yep.
And I, being an engineer, I think the best way is to just talk to the engineers who worked on it, who are going to tell you very honestly what the product yep. is about. Good marketing is about taking that honesty mm-hmm. and taking it out into the space. And making it clear and simple. So I do think you have to dig a little bit. If you're shopping around for security products, you do have to talk to the companies, do have to talk to the engineers a little bit. I think the testers definitely play a big role here in short-circuiting that. If you can find a tester that you trust, mm-hmm. I think they can dramatically simplify and at least give you a funnel, so you can at least say, all right, you know, there's these 10 vendors. I've looked at this test. This test is fair and transparent. You know, I'm going to only look at these three.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a big role for testers to play in that regard.
That makes a lot of sense. And maybe jump off with some questions that the testing didn't answer for you and like operationally, right?
Yeah, for sure. And if you don't understand a part of the test, that's a great thing to ask a vendor, mm-hmm. to be honest with you. Like, you know, like I'd love getting a question about that. Like, hey, it looked like you did well in this test, part of the test, but you didn't do well in this part of this test. Tell me about that. That's really great. Or what technologies do you think were the most effective in this test? Great questions to get you to learn more about the product.
That's awesome. That's an interesting point because yeah. what we know is a lot of the customers are trying to simplify the security products they've got. So if you can identify certain strengths in, say, Adam's product and maybe a weakness, then you know that you have to still fill that gap with something.
Mm-hmm.
But to fully understand the products or to better understand them will help you actually in your task of simplifying and not having 30 different EDR products in your network.
Yeah. That's interesting. Use it as a jumping off point, right? You can filter and then now we can have like realistic discussions about, you know, what we need to kind of solve this
and
challenge.
Don't just read SE Labs reports, right? Yeah. So there's a bunch of different testers out there.
You heard it from him. He didn't
trademark
that.
Well, I'm just saying, like if they're all saying that Broadcom's good and I'm saying Broadcom's good and we all test in different ways and some of us are better than others, but if everyone is coming to the same conclusion, it's probably right. Whereas if you see these two are saying something's terrible and these two are saying it's great, or one of them saying it's kind of average, mm-hmm. then that's more complicated. But you can take a lot of the work out by doing a quick survey. What are the current results for my favorite considered products?
Yep.
And if everyone's in agreement, that kind of sounds quite positive.
Yeah, it validates, right? You
yeah.
get more evidence to the point.
Yeah.
Well, and final question for you. If you could change one thing about how cybersecurity products are tested or marketed, what would it be?
I think the marketing should be more honest because I think at the moment, I think people have got mature enough to see through it and over claims, I think does a disservice to the engineering. And from some of the customers I talk to, they don't even go to RSA and stuff anymore because mm-hmm. they see it as a pony show and they're just being taken out for drinks. And what they really want is the better product for their networks.
Yeah.
And it's the marketing puts them off.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know whether people can just wind it down a bit, but that's probably what I would advise.
As we walk into the Black Hat conference,
yeah,
and go look
yeah,
at
on
AI.
A podcast.
Yes, AI is just going to fix everything.
But I think it's about making unlikely claims, isn't it? It's not yeah. about telling people how great your product is. It's saying we can stop 100% of the threats, which is not possible,
yeah.
or we are better than them, or whatever it is, you know. And there have been some absolute howlers in the past, and I'm not going to say, but we all know.
We'll do the next episode.
Yeah.
We'll do
the yeah, tune in next week.
10.
Simon's favorite
yeah.
marketing. Yeah.
Yeah, some have been just obviously dishonest, and yeah. I think that doesn't help reputations.
Totally agree. Well, I think that's a wrap. Thank you guys for coming on today. massive thanks, Simon, Adam. I will say it, if you're gonna do some testing, hit up Simon, only ones you need to worry about right now. Check out more insights and technical deep dives at security.com, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and share the show with your fellow defenders. Thanks for listening, and remember, stay sharp, stay curious, and stay human.